Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and I'm coming down from a big win.
What's that, Tracy?
The Warriors won the NBA championships. This Oakland girl is feeling really good right now.
You do look pretty happy.
I am. I think, you know, this is a poverty show, so I will say Oakland has its challenges. So this is something that we needed.
I don't know. I feel like Cleveland kind of really needs some sports wins. Like, you know, historically, it would be nice if they had one or two.
Oh, well, we haven't had a win in 40 years. Oakland deserves something, okay?
All right.
Anyway, we've got a lot has happened this week, I think, in the news besides basketball.
Things have happened.
I wanted to read you a quote. This is my favorite quote of the week.
Do I have to guess who it is?
Sure. Instead of a number of the week, we'll have a speaker of the week.
Quote of the week.
Okay. So this is from, I'll give you a hint later. So the person said, "I'm really rich. That's the kind of thinking you need for this country. It sounds crass. It's not crass."
Well, it does sound crass. So I feel like there are only a handful of people who might actually have said that with a straight face. Was this perhaps said in the context of making some kind of an announcement?
That is correct.
Was it someone with really bad hair?
I think you know who it is.
Sounds like a Donald Trump quote to me.
Ding, ding, ding. You won the first official personal quote of the week.
Which is a really catchy title, Tracy. You better trademark that one fast.
I'll figure out another one if we get a great quote again.
I think we'll work on the title. But I would just like to say that as a 501c3 radio show, that is all we can say about that quote. So let's move on.
And it speaks for itself.
It does, though. It's good. No comment needed.
All right. So you've got a lot of interviews for this episode. Walk me through it. What are we doing this week?
Yeah, I kind of kicked you out of the show, didn't I?
I'll be back next week.
You will. You will be back with a dominating force next week, I hear, based on the interviews you're doing. So I had a couple of great conversations. One in particular was a special feature with Ian Millhiser. He's the justice editor at Think Progress. We talk about, well, who he thinks are the five worst Supreme Court justices in the history of the Supreme Court. He actually does get it down to five.
And there are
some new names, new faces for folks to hear about in terms of who's treated low-income individuals and really, you know, the country badly. And we also talk about the cases that are coming down the pike, King v. Burwell and more.
Awesome. And what else do you have for us?
You sound very interested, Tracy.
I promise. I have faith that you and Ian are going to have a great conversation.
We do.
As much as my awesome sounded dismissive, it was like, yeah, I'm confident in you guys.
We do. We do have a good conversation. I also have a great chat with RJ Eskow. He is the host of The Zero Hour, which is also a WEACT radio show. And we actually talk, well, vent perhaps is the better word, about Orange is the New Black, which really took sort of a disappointing turn with its first episode. And you got to listen to find out why. You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And with me for a very special feature to discuss the Supreme Court and what kinds of cases it has coming down the pike that impact poverty is Ian Millhiser. He's justice editor at Think Progress, and he's also the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Thanks for joining Talk Poverty Radio, Ian.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
So I wanted to start off, actually, by talking a little bit about your book before we get too much into the thick of which cases are coming down the pike.
Sure thing.
So you actually have on the book jacket, the justices of the Supreme Court have shaped a nation where children toiled in coal mines, where Americans could be forced into camps because of their race, and where a woman could be sterilized against her will by state law. You further continue, the court was the midwife of Jim Crow, the right hand of union busters, and the dead hand of the Confederacy. So your book, just judging from this quote, not super complimentary of the Supreme Court. What shapes your opinion?
Well, I mean, I can tell you the origin story of the book, which is that I worked very hard on the first Supreme Court case that was trying to strike down the Affordable Care Act. And that case, you know, one very prominent conservative judge said that that case's legal theory had no basis in Supreme Court precedent or in the Constitution's text. I mean, it really was a very silly legal theory. And yet we came within a hair of losing the entire law. And, you know, when I think about what would have happened, you know, I write about in the book, there was a woman who was raped and was told by the insurance companies that her rape was a pre-existing condition.
Ugh.
So she could not get health insurance. I write about a family in there where the wife had a heart condition and the husband was in a motorcycle accident. And they had enough money to pay for his care or to pay for her care. Now, no human being should have to make that choice, but certainly no American should have to make that choice. And, you know, the fact that the Supreme Court came so close to taking us back to that world, that should wound your soul. And what I found when I looked through the Supreme Court's history was that cases like that are not uncommon. They have been the norm throughout most of the Supreme Court's history. And I think that that's, you know, an underappreciated aspect of American history that I wanted people to be aware of.
So your book came out in March, and actually as one of the posts that you wrote for Think Progress discussing the book and promoting it, you did kind of a fun little exercise where you ranked the worst Supreme Court justices in American history. Now, you limited yourself to five, mm-hmm. right, which was noble of you and perhaps judicious, pun intended. Mm-hmm. Who were the five worst justices and why?
The worst justice is someone that most people probably have not heard of, which is this guy named Stephen Field. He was appointed to the Supreme Court during the Civil War, served for most of the late 19th century. And he came onto the court with the notion that the purpose of the Constitution was to protect businesses, was to protect the wealthy, was to make sure that we didn't have regulation of either what wealthy businessmen were doing, or in one case, he railed against the income tax because he said that it was terrible that we were taxing rich people to the benefit of poorer people. So that was his approach to the Constitution. There wasn't actually anything in the Constitution that supports what he was trying to do.
Not really.
But he was very successful in pushing these ideas. And towards the end of his life, many of his notions were embraced by a majority of the Supreme Court. Shortly after he died, the Supreme Court fully embraced his vision of the Constitution and used it to do things like say that we couldn't have a minimum wage, we couldn't have laws protecting workers in the workplace, we couldn't have laws protecting the right to unionize. And so he, possibly more than any other American of his age, did more to keep entrenched wealth entrenched and to ensure that people who were less fortunate stayed that way.
Well, I have to say, having gone to law school and working on poverty, I'm embarrassed that I have never heard of him before reading your piece, but definitely someone we should all know more about. So second on your list was someone hopefully our listeners have heard of, Chief Justice Roger Taney.
I feel like I'm surprised I didn't get more hate mail for the fact that I place someone ahead of Taney on this list.
I was surprised to see him at number two. I will admit.
I think that to some extent, I did that intentionally because I wanted to emphasize the sheer amount of misery that Field's libertarian approach created when he was on the court. But no, Taney is best known for the worst decision that he wrote, and arguably the worst decision that has ever been written in the Supreme Court's history, which was the Dred Scott decision.
Yes.
And the Dred Scott decision was more than just a pro-slavery decision. It said that black people have no rights that the white man is obligated to recognize. So it was, at once like a pro-slavery decision, and it stood for the premise that at least within the United States, white supremacy was very much in the natural order of things. And that was something that the Supreme Court did not abandon. I mean, even after we ratified three constitutional amendments to get rid of Dred Scott, a lot of what I discuss in the book is how for many, many years, the Supreme Court tried to write those amendments out of the Constitution and maintain that same white supremacist society. And in many cases, maintain systems such as peonage, which looked a whole lot like slavery to the people who were stuck in them.
Now, third on your list, another person I had not heard of before, but Justice James Clark McReynolds, and you describe him as having a unique blend of self-centered bigotry. Tell us a little bit about this character.
Yeah, I mean, McReynolds makes the list just because he's such an awful human being. I mean, quite possibly the worst human that has ever served on the Supreme Court.
A bold statement.
Well, I mean, he used to do things like, for one year, there wasn't a picture, there wasn't an official picture of the, because like every year they would sit the justices down, they'd take an official photograph. And one year there wasn't an official photograph because the court always sits according to seniority.
Right.
And that year he had to sit next to Justice Brandeis, and he refused to sit next to Brandeis because Brandeis was Jewish.
He wouldn't sit next to him.
There was no picture, and it wasn't just Jews that he hated. When Charles Hamilton Houston, who's one of the pioneering African American attorneys in American history, argued before the court, McReynolds would turn his back to him. When a woman would argue in front of the Supreme Court, he announced to the room, "I see that the female is here," and then he would get up and walk away.
This guy is a charmer.
There was an amazing memoir written by one of his former law clerks describing what a terrible boss this guy was. And of course, what he did to the law was also monstrous. You know, he was one of the so-called four horsemen that did everything that they could to prevent the New Deal from going into effect. He stood for this notion that we couldn't have a minimum wage. We couldn't have laws protecting workers. I believe he was one of the few justices who voted to strike down Social Security in its entirety. So he was a real winner. My kind of guy.
And you describe him as actually bringing one of his clerks with him. A servant with him when he went duck hunting, and he would force the man to actually wade through ice cold water to pick up the animals he had shot instead of bringing a dog with him.
He was too cheap to get dogs.
I'm laughing, but this is terrible.
Yeah, no, I mean, like I said, like probably the worst human being that has ever served on the Supreme Court. He was really just if I made him up, you wouldn't believe in him.
No, I agree with that. All right. And at this point, it makes me wonder if it's even worth going through the rest of the list, right? You name Chief Justice Melville Fuller, and you also name, well, Clarence Thomas makes the list too, right?
Yeah.
So you should probably explain why Clarence Thomas is on the list.
So here's the thing about Justice Thomas. I describe so much in my book, court striking down child labor laws, the court saying that we couldn't have civil rights laws, the court saying that, you know, that basically workers were helpless. And most people hear these stories and they think, well, that's terrible. That's also the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
they think of that as something that America has moved past. And yet if you read Justice Thomas's opinions, he has called for us to go back to that. I mean, if you take what he has said about the scope of congressional power seriously, then the ban on whites-only lunch counters is unconstitutional under Thomas's view of the Constitution. You know, we could not have federal child labor laws under Thomas's view of the Constitution. And so what I think makes Thomas particularly odious is, you know, I don't want to excuse people like Field and McReynolds and people like that who stopped these laws the first time around. But before the Industrial Revolution, and really before the New Deal, the idea of a modern regulatory and welfare state was something that hadn't been tried before.
Right.
So it was possible to, you know, in, say, 1917, look at this new idea and say, oh, well, this is new and scary, and maybe I should try to stop it. Clarence Thomas has the benefit of the last 80 years of American history. He has seen, you know, he knows that the New Deal happened and we did not crash into some sort of fascist Marxism. And yes, they would conflate those two things.
Subject for another episode of Talk Poverty Radio.
Yeah, that's not what happened. What happened is that America became the wealthiest nation in the history of money and the most powerful nation in the history of power. You know, if I can give any type of complimentary gloss over what happened in the past, the one thing I could say is at least they didn't know better. Justice Thomas knows better, mm-hmm. and yet he still is pushing to build us a nice bridge back to the 19th century.
The dividing line between being pure, just narrowly conservative and being truly reactionary,
right.
if you will. So I want to segue into talking about some of the cases that are actually before the Supreme Court mm-hmm. as we speak, cases that matter a lot for low-income Americans, Americans who might be low-income at some point right. or who are struggling to make ends meet. You have identified four cases that we as Americans should mm-hmm. know about, and actually decisions could come down any day now.
That's right.
So I think in a conversation like this, we probably have to start with King v. Burwell. Tell us a little bit about that case and why it matters to all of us.
So King v. Burwell is the weakest case I have ever seen reach the Supreme Court. This is an effort to take health care away from millions of Americans by, according to one brief that was filed in the case, just under 10,000 people will die every year who otherwise would have lived if the plaintiffs prevail in this case.
I feel like we should pause and let people take that in. Say that one more time.
Yeah, just under 10,000 people who otherwise would have lived will die if the plaintiffs prevail in this case.
So the stakes are high here.
It's a very serious case. The issue here is it's an attempt to essentially get the Supreme Court to rewrite the Affordable Care Act. So the Affordable Care Act creates these health exchanges where many people are able to purchase health insurance. One of the features of this exchange is that if your income is in a certain range, you are entitled to get a subsidy that helps you to pay for that health insurance that you're buying. And the plaintiffs in this case focus on a few words in the statute. It refers to an exchange established by the state.
Right.
And they claim that where these words appear, it means that only exchanges that are operated by a state government, which is only a little more than a dozen of them, as opposed to being operated by the federal government, which is the overwhelming majority of the states, that those subsidies must be cut off, that insurance must suddenly become unaffordable for millions of people, that could trigger what's known as a death spiral, where it disrupts the healthcare market and eventually the entire individual insurance market collapses. And of course, that thousands of people should die because they will no longer be able to afford the care they're entitled to under the law. The problem with this legal theory is that it asks you to read one sentence of the law completely out of context. It's like reading The Hunger Games and concluding that it's a treatise about why you shouldn't eat poison berries. I mean, you know, that's their theory of how you should read the law. So their idea, so the problem with it is that the word exchange is defined in the law. It's defined to say that any exchange, regardless of whether it's a state exchange or a federal exchange, shall be deemed to be an exchange that is established by a state. So the word is defined, any exchange, regardless of who operates it, counts as an exchange established by the state. You know, if you read one sentence, you might think they're onto something here. But if you're capable of reading two sentences, and I will point out that every single one of the justices has an Ivy League law degree. So if, you know, Harvard and Yale law schools have taught them the important skill of reading two entire sentences, then this will be a 9-0 decision. Unfortunately, because of the politics of Obamacare and, you know, the fact that a majority of the Supreme Court belongs to the political party that does not like Obamacare, there's a little more uncertainty as to what the outcome's going to be.
Well, in the words of a few good men, hopefully they weren't sick the day they taught law in law school. We'll find out. So that's King v. Burwell. And I think a case that's probably gotten a lot less attention comparatively, and which you argue might actually be the most undercovered and one of the most important cases before the Supreme Court right now, is called Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs versus the Inclusive Communities Project. Now, what is this case about?
So this is, at the very least, a direct assault on civil rights laws protecting against housing discrimination and potentially a much broader assault on much of the framework that prevents discrimination anywhere in our law. So the idea here, there are, broadly speaking, two different types of discrimination suits that you can bring if you're a victim of discrimination. There's something called disparate treatment, which is very hard to prove. Disparate treatment normally means that you can prove that the person who engaged in discrimination actually had racist or sexist or some other impermissible intent. And that's very hard. You know, in 2015, most employers, most lenders, most renters, you know, most people who do business are smart enough not to write the smoking gun email where they say, hey, let's not hire any black people. And so because racism or sexism or other forms of discrimination is typically hidden, the law also allows for something called disparate impact discrimination. And the way that disparate impact discrimination works is that if you can show that a particular policy leads to worse outcomes statistically for people who are racial minorities or women or whatever, then you can bring that person into court and require them to say, like, at least stand up and say, hey, we had a legitimate reason for doing this that wasn't racist, and here's what it is. And if they aren't able to give you a good reason, or if the reason isn't believable, then that is sufficient to prove discrimination.
So it's the difference between needing that smoking gun that actually proves that your landlord or whoever was racist in their heart, in the words of Alan Pike,
right,
on a previous episode of Talk Poverty Radio, and needing numbers that bear out the case statistically.
Right. It's an ability to prove discrimination based on circumstances. So, like, you know, if there are 100 qualified applicants for 30 slots and half of those applicants are black – and none of those slots go to black people, you know, maybe there's a reason for that. You know, maybe it's a coincidence and it just happened that all the white people were more qualified. And if that is the case, then, like, people who are accused of discrimination will get a chance to step forward and say, hey, like, we had a legitimate reason for that. But the most likely explanation for that kind of thing is discrimination. And what these lawsuits do is they allow that sort of hidden discrimination, when there isn't necessarily a smoking gun, to be exposed.
So is the fact that the Supreme Court even actually granted cert in this case and agreed to hear it, is that itself a bad sign?
Well, it's even worse than you say. So, you know, what specifically this case is about is it's whether these disparate impact suits are permissible in the context of fair housing. So if the plaintiffs win, it's just going to nuke much of the ability of people who are victims of housing discrimination to prevail in court. 11 lower courts of appeals, federal courts of appeals, have considered whether or not the Fair Housing Act permits disparate impact suits. All 11 of them agree that it does. This same issue has been in front of the Supreme Court on two separate occasions, both times that case settled, and the Supreme Court keeps taking the case up. And then on top of that, Chief Justice Roberts, as far back as when – I mean, this is how long this crusade goes. When Roberts was a young attorney in the Reagan administration, he worked on a memo that compared disparate impact litigation to quotas, which is the most toxic word you can use in racial justice litigation. I mean, quotas are something that everyone agrees at this stage that you can't have affirmative action with quotas, and this isn't even an affirmative action program.
And just for our listeners, how does a quota work?
So a quota would be if you had, you know, if you had a job, there were 50 slots, and you said, we're going to decide in advance that 25 of these go to black people, and 10 of them go to Latinos, and 15 of them go to some, and then, like, that's not done.
That's what we can't do.
Yeah, like, I mean, that it was established in the 1980s that that's unconstitutional. That's why the word quota is such a toxic word. When you use the word quota, you are saying that this reaches the level of someone that, you know, everyone agrees is unconstitutional at this stage. And Roberts used that word to describe this thing, which, you know, A, isn't affirmative action, and B, isn't a quota.
Right.
But it shows that there is a long standing crusade amongst a certain segment of the conservative legal community to shrink down civil rights laws to the point where they're virtually worthless. You know, one prong of that is by eliminating these disparate impact suits. And I'm very worried about this case. You know, I'm worried that given that there was no disagreement amongst the lower courts, given that they keep taking it up, and given that, you know, there is this evidence that there's this long crusade against disparate impact litigation, I'm worried about what the Supreme Court's going to do here.
Well, and the evidence is clear of why we need to have these remedies, right? I mean, we today, massive housing discrimination on the basis of race actually does persist. It might feel like something from yesterday,
right,
but there actually are very compelling data that you point out that really make the case for why we need these remedies today, and taking the teeth out of them really would be the wrong way to go.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, Chief Justice Roberts especially, I think, has a very naive approach to race. You know, you saw this in his case striking down a big chunk of the Voting Rights Act. And his argument in that case was essentially, oh, there's just not enough racism anymore to justify having the fully operational Voting Rights Act. And, you know, I think that that's a narrative that privileged, wealthy white people like Chief Justice Roberts often like to tell themselves, like, oh, you know, there was this bad time and we used to have all this racism kicking around in America, but now racism's fixed. And no, that's not true. It's not true in the voting rights context. It certainly isn't true in the housing context. You know, so just throw a, you know, one thing out there. During the subprime lending boom, Black borrowers with good credit scores, these, you know, if you take Black borrowers who had the same financial portfolio, you know, the same financial status as an equivalent white borrower, they were still 3.5 times as likely as whites with similar credit scores to receive higher interest loans. The Latinos were 3.1 times more likely to receive loans with higher interest rates. Mm-hmm. And we need a law to address it. The law that's supposed to address it is this disparate impact law.
So another case that you have lifted up and said really isn't receiving quite enough attention is a case called Arizona State Legislature versus Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission. Mm-hmm. And this is a case about gerrymandering. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Sure. So this is, you know, this is a very technical case. It's about the Arizona, the people of Arizona enacted a ballot initiative which said that rather than having district lines be drawn for congressional districts and for state legislative districts be drawn by the legislature, which obviously has a stake in how those lines are drawn because often they're their own seats, they would instead be drawn by an independent commission. This was supposed to get rid of gerrymandering. And it's proved fairly successful in that regard. The theory of this lawsuit is that the Constitution says that the manner of choosing members of Congress shall be determined by the legislature of the state. And so the question is, does the word legislature there, does that only mean, you know, what we typically mean when we refer to as legislature, which is the House and Senate, the state House and the state Senate, or does it mean what the Supreme Court has said it has meant for at least 100 years, which it means whatever body in that state has the power to make laws. You know, in this case, there was a ballot initiative. The people of the state made that law. And so for constitutional purposes, the Supreme Court has always says that qualifies them as the legislature of the state. If this case is lost, two things are going to happen. One is that this anti-gerrymandering commission goes away and the Republican-controlled legislature in Arizona is going to draw new maps that are going to be much more favorable to Republicans, at least at the congressional level. The second thing that's going to happen, though, is that it's not like this is the only time that a ballot initiative was passed that affects some states' election law. You know, Oregon is vote by mail. That came in through a ballot initiative. You know, in some states, things that, you know, I don't like very much happen through ballot initiative. You know, Mississippi, they got a voter ID law that way. But there are a lot of states that have a lot of law affecting their elections that was done by a ballot initiative. And if this case prevails, what the Supreme Court's essentially doing is they're taking a red pen to all these states' election laws and randomly crossing out lines. Mm-hmm. That's going to create chaos. You know, states aren't going to know what their own law is. People aren't going to know how they vote if they're registered to vote in some cases. And it's going to have a tremendous impact on low-income communities. Because first of all, like, you know, you're talking about the communities that may not have access to the sort of legal counsel you might suddenly need to figure out what you're going to have to do in order to vote. And second of all, even if you know what the law is, there's a lot of lawmakers in this country who don't want poor people to vote because they think they'll vote against them.
Or they don't want Black people to vote.
Or they don't want Black people to vote. And, or, you know, or they don't want Latinos to vote. And those lawmakers, if a law is suddenly removed from the books that was intended to make it easier for people to vote, they aren't going to be inclined to put that law back.
So is there any good news in what the Supreme Court has before it on this docket?
Well, I mean, you know, the one piece of good news that I think is getting a lot of attention is the marriage equality case. You know, here is the one area where I think the Supreme Court is likely to do the right thing, and like not just do the right thing. You know, I think the good news will probably also win the health care case.
Are we knocking on wood while you say that? I think that the entire radio studio is made of wood. We're knocking on all of it.
Yes, but you know, in the marriage equality case, like the Supreme Court could actually make the law better than it was before they got their hands on it, which isn't something that happens every year or every decade. What it looks like is going to happen is, you know, right now most states have marriage equality either because of a court order or because of an act of the legislature or ballot initiative. Now it looks like we're going to have marriage equality in all 50 states. It's good news that that's happening. At the same time, you know, it's about freaking time. I'm serious about that. I mean, the standard for discrimination under the Constitution is that when a group has faced irrational discrimination that bears no relation to their ability to contribute to society, that's generally viewed as unconstitutional. And there's just no question that gay people have been subject to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, until frighteningly recently, the federal government would not hire gay employees. And I could read you this long justification I have that they offered for why they had this policy. It uses words like revulsion. So, yeah,
sure.
There's a long history of anti-gay discrimination, unconstitutional discrimination by the government. It's about time the Supreme Court got around to figuring that out.
So I think we'll let you have the last word on that one, Ian. It's about freaking time. Thank you so much. Ian Millhiser, Justice Editor at Think Progress, and also author of Injustices, The Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and we're back with the Weekly Worst. We're joined by our friend Alan Pike of Think Progress. Welcome, Alan.
Hey, thanks.
Glad to have you here. What do you have for us this week? What are the three worst stories in the poverty realm?
All right. First up, I'll lead with a quote and give you guys a chance to guess who it is. Quote, I don't know if she fully understands the global banking system. Anybody?
Meaning who's the she or who said it?
Both.
Well, if it's
two-part
a she
question.
And banking, I'm going to go with Elizabeth Warren.
The she is Elizabeth Warren. It's one down.
I don't know who said it.
Who said it? Could have been Rush Limbaugh.
It could have been. Instead, it was one of the most powerful and widely respected men in global finance. J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon said on Wednesday that Elizabeth Warren, her problem is that she doesn't really get it on how the banking system works. This is a woman who taught corporate law for 20 years at Harvard, then headed up the government's oversight board for bank bailouts in the wake of the financial crisis, and then helped design and launch the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau during the fight for industry reform in 2010. Dimon's personal wealth just cracked the $1 billion mark. He's been a fixture in the industry for just as long as she's been learning about it and following how it works. And that tenure has included overseeing J.P. Morgan during a number of scandals involving the bank's persistent habit of rigging markets to benefit insiders and goose their own profits at the expense of taxpayers and consumers. Warren responded the next day, by the way, by saying that Dimon's real problem isn't that she doesn't understand his business, but that she understands it too well. The problem for these guys is that I understand how they make their money, is what she said in part.
So wait, what was his accusation exactly? Like, why does he think she doesn't get the banking system?
Because why else would she be so critical of them? So there are all these within every corner of the financial industry reform and regulatory work of the U.S. government and of all governments. There are all these really, really detailed, complicated issues with annoying acronyms and that are predicated on an understanding of, you know, some complex mathematical constructs and how things like debt and bond issuance and stuff like that work. Which, granted, is plenty complicated for a layperson. But when you're talking about somebody like Elizabeth Warren, who's been making not just a sort of fiery populist critique of the industry for a generation now, but heading up and helping to create some of the most dynamic and sort of in real time responsive institutions that are tasked with going through what banks say they're doing and figuring out when they're not doing what they say they're doing. It's a little absurd to assert that she's just ignorant, and that's why she seems to think everything's wrong.
I mean, it's the, you know, we don't want to be regulated. We don't want any scrutiny. We don't want any oversight of us. And so, therefore, anyone who thinks that we need that must not understand us, defense.
So, in conclusion, Elizabeth Warren knows a thing or two about banking. What's the next story?
She's
up to speed.
What's the next one?
All right, Kansas. We're going to Kansas from Wall Street. Short trip. Kansas's poor and middle class are going to face higher taxes after the state's Republican-controlled legislature approved a measure raising tobacco taxes and sales taxes and canceling a variety of tax deductions that were primarily used by non-rich taxpayers. They did all that because Governor Sam Brownback's 2012 and 2013 tax cuts, which had already delivered a massive windfall to the richest people in the state and already slightly raised tax obligations for the poor, those same tax cuts created a nearly billion-dollar deficit for the coming fiscal year. And through a combination of sort of one-time transfers and spending cuts and this set of tax hikes that passed on Friday, that's how they've decided to address it, rather than walking back some of these disastrous income tax cuts that the Brownback administration pushed for. So overall, out of almost $400 million of new revenue projected from this bill, 42% comes from the sales tax. And just 6% is going to come from wealthier taxpayers who've been able to avoid income taxes entirely in the past couple of years, thanks to one of Brownback's tax ideas.
And of course, sales taxes are incredibly regressive. So it sounds like Brownback may have recently enrolled in a webinar on how to make your tax code in your state even more regressive.
I like that you said he enrolled in a webinar. I envision him at his desk.
I had a visual there, right?
There's a lot of clicking and angry yelling toward his assistant, I'm guessing, at the start of a webinar.
Okay, Alan, what's the third story?
All right. Third is a group of guards for a company called Prison Transport Services, which is a contractor that moves people between incarceration facilities for governments that decide not to manage their criminal justice populations themselves, allegedly urinated on, beat, and attempted to extort a prisoner named Darren Richardson during a ride from Florida to Pennsylvania. Richardson suing is why we know that these allegations are out there, in part because when he got to the prison he was headed to in Pennsylvania, his lower extremities were black and purple from having had his circulation cut off by shackles that were too tight. He also says that guards held a shotgun to his head during an attempt to extort him. And the nurse who tended to him in the Pennsylvania prison's medical ward apparently told him that she'd seen people come off of PTS vans in much worse shape. This is, again, all according to Richardson's lawsuit. And PTS has a track record here. There was a woman arrested for shoplifting who ended up dying in one of their vans last year. And there's a separate lawsuit in Texas alleging that the company kept a woman shackled and without water for two straight days during a sweltering summer heat wave.
Obviously, like, we try to make the Weekly Wars lighthearted and fun, but that is just really hard to listen to, and I don't even need to recap. Like, I'm voting for that one. I think that's just preposterous, and I think I'm at least happy that our country's having a fairly candid conversation these days about criminal justice reform, but what's described in that lawsuit, the fact that it's believable, that, I mean, we have to use the word alleged, but it's believable, and I think it's just horrible, and I don't think that that's something that we can stand for in this country, and I think there's a lot of problems with profit-driven entities somehow supposedly going to rehabilitate people, which is what prison is supposed to be about.
Supposed to be.
Well, yeah, and I think that it's tempting to think that it's tempting to downplay the role that privatization of these public services plays in abuses like this, in light of things like what's been happening at Rikers for, you know, years and years and years that we've all started to learn about thanks to investigations by the New Yorker and other media outlets up there. But I think that's a false. It's tempting to think that any time you put one human being or one group of human beings in such complete control over the well-being and liberty of another, that you're going to get these kinds of abusive outcomes. And there's all kinds of, you know, there's the Stanford Prison Experiment. Right. There's all these kinds of, like, Psych 101 examples of the human tendency toward misbehaving and being really inhumane to other human beings in such circumstances. But I think it's absolutely vital to keep at least one eye on the role of government decision-making here and lawmakers and elected officials who rather than start to extract more public resources from people who are well-positioned to pay higher taxes, they allow budget pressures to coerce them into privatizing these really core public duties, even to people who have broken the law, perhaps especially to people who have broken the law. It's our society's job to do that stuff the right way rather than shuffle it off onto somebody else's desk and pretend we don't know what's happening.
Well, and I'm actually really glad that you brought up Rikers, right? Because I think, yes, Tracy, you're right that when we privatize, and I'll just come right out and say I'm voting for this one too. There was sort of almost no point in having a contest here. This one so thoroughly wins. Yes, when you privatize these types of industries and government services, yeah, you do end up with a lot in the way of abuses. But this stuff happens even when you don't privatize, right? So right. I think there's this tendency to think of so-called criminals, you know, these awful people as sort of subhuman in some way, as though they don't actually deserve the same protections of our Constitution and really just the same kind of basic human dignity that other humans do. I would share Tracy's optimism and appreciation that we're having a productive and bipartisan conversation about criminal justice reform right now in this country that is starting to recognize that we need prison reform and that we shouldn't just be locking people up and throwing away the key, that it matters what happens while they're there and that we do need to be focusing on rehabilitation. But guys, we've totally failed to make this weekly worst lighthearted.
But I think just to summarize everything that we've been getting at, you know, to Alan's point, people think that we can get the private sector to come in and correct the failings of the government. Mm-hmm. And this is an example that that's not the case. And hopefully we can do a better job of holding our public institutions accountable so that we don't see the sorts of things that we have seen in Rikers Island. But all across the board, what people are facing in this country in our criminal justice system is abhorrent, and the mass incarceration of itself, the fact that so many people are being arrested for horrible reasons, is mm-hmm. another issue that we'll be going into a lot, I'm sure, over the course of our show.
And Tracy, to anyone who would say that the private sector can do it better, I have one word for you: Comcast.
And I think that's the final word on this episode's Weekly Worst. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And with me is RJ Eskow of The Zero Hour, also on the WEACT Radio Network and other stations. RJ, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
And I wish I were inviting you to talk about a more pleasant topic, but there don't seem to be many of those available these days. But I was interested in speaking with you a little bit about a scene that actually is one of the very first scenes in the new season of Orange is the New Black, which Netflix just made available, you know, for binging pleasure for Americans who like to sit and watch nothing but Netflix for 24 hours of a weekend this past weekend. And one of the very first scenes in that first season, I found really troubling. Let me describe it a little bit for our listeners who either have seen it or might not have seen it. There's a character, she's the one who's known as Pensatucky on the show. She flashes back to her childhood, and it's a scene with her as a child and her mother. And her mother is with her, and she's forcing her to really chug really fast a whole 2-liter bottle of Mountain Dew. And then right after she finishes chugging that huge bottle of Mountain Dew, the camera zooms in on a Social Security Administration sign, which is painted on the window behind them. And the mom is talking to an eligibility worker at the Social Security office, and she says to her, "So I understand supplemental security income benefits for kids like mine are $314 a month. Is that right?" So I wanted to talk with you about this and sort of the significance of this scene and really the myths and misperceptions that it's bringing, you know, back up.
Yeah, well, what people have been saying about that scene, and I think it may have come up in another episode or been alluded to, is that supposedly it's to make her behave as if she has ADHD or ADD, to make her hyperactive, so that somehow that will fool the Social Security examiner. Part of what's really cruel to me about that kind of misrepresentation. I mean, it seems people may say it's only a television program or whatever, but the fact is it's making people think lightly of these SSI payments to children. The way they really work, and this is according to Social Security Administration itself, the child must have a physical or mental condition or combination of conditions that results in, and I'm quoting now from the regulations, marked and severe functional limitations. They also say elsewhere the condition cannot be medically demonstrated, then it's not reimbursable. And another, give you another condition. The child's condition must have been disabling or expect to be disabling for at least 12 months or must be expected to result in the death of the child. So this is not, and by the way, most applicants, according to at least anecdotal writing by disability examiners and others, most applicants for child payments of this kind get turned down. I also happen to have in front of me from the Social Security website the information you have to bring in if you are a parent trying to get these payments, and there's a 12-point checklist. I mean, I won't go through the whole thing, Rebecca, but name and address and phone number of every doctor, therapist, hospital, and clinic, all medical records, medications the child is taking, school psychologists to be spoken with, school counselors, a number of anything, you know, individualized family service plan for early intervention services, you know, names of social work, social programs, on and on and on. So this is not the kind of thing that you just, you know, hype your kid up on Mountain Dew, which really no child should drink anyway, but this is not something where you just wire your kid on Mountain Dew and go in and you get your $312 a month. This is for kids with horrifying, you know, really truly disabling conditions, and it's very hard to get. A lot of applicants get turned down, particularly applicants for ADHD are very frequently turned down, usually turned down.
And
because
to underscore that point, RJ, which you mentioned earlier, that advocates and others will sometimes point to anecdotal evidence that most people who apply get denied. When you actually look at the numbers as well, the vast majority of children who apply for SSI disability benefits or have their families apply for them are denied. It's somewhere between 3 and 4 out of 10 kids actually get approved after every layer of appeal. And as you note, when you actually look at the data on ADHD, ADHD cases are one of the hardest to get approved for. It's
right,
closer to 25% of applicants, a little bit less. So, I mean, that you're exactly right that what, and the reason I was so concerned when I saw this scene, and have had, you know, I've talked to other folks who care about the SSI program who have been similarly concerned, is this is not the first time that we have seen the media or now it's Hollywood actually sort of casting aspersions on the kids' SSI program. This is just the latest in a long line of what we've seen. And it brought back memories, actually, of a Boston Globe series that ran about 4 or 5 years ago that said, you know, parents are forcing their kids to, quote, fake disabilities. We've seen Kristoff in the Times make similar accusations. So, you know, this isn't new, but it's really, as you said, serious when it leaks into, you know, mainstream culture like this.
Right. I mean, we're talking about a program that's there to help seriously disabled children. So when that was, you know, when I started off by saying, Rebecca, that, you know, I was upset by it, it's because we're really making a mockery of a program that is supposed to be there for children, you know, under the cruelest circumstances. You would never wish on any child, and to make it seem like it's a game. And by the way, it's also, I just want to add, it's also extremely insensitive towards children who genuinely suffer from demonstrable ADHD. It is not like being hyped up on a caffeinated soda. It affects cognition, it affects behavior, it affects mood. It is definitely something you have to struggle against, and when it is severe, your teachers have to work with you, you need special provisions of various kinds. So you can overcome it, you can have a great life with it, but it is not something to be trivialized in that way either.
And does it seem to you to be in line with sort of modern day persistent mistrust of mental impairments as being somehow less real than physical impairments?
Yeah, I think we suffer from, I think they used to call it Manichaean, you know, the mind-body split, that somehow the body is real and the mind is not, when modern medical science tells us that the two are interconnected and that mood disorders and conditions of that nature have physical as well as mental components, and even if they didn't, they represent genuine and real human suffering and shouldn't be trivialized. You know, this goes back to some of the comments about adult disability too that Rand Paul and others have made, saying, well, you know, people in the military getting stigmatized for shirking when they have post-traumatic stress disorder, which can be a very disabling condition. It all displays an enormous lack of compassion and empathy, and we really do need to push back at it whenever possible.
And it also really displays, right, a lack of understanding about these programs. You know, Social Security Disability Insurance, Supplemental Security Income, they get a lot of media attention in waves and usually not good, and in ways that has real policy consequences. So this scene, for whatever reason, reminded me of a column that you wrote that actually took a look at House of Cards and the way that House of Cards treated Social Security. And I'll let you explain what that was, but a lot of people said, oh, it's just pop culture, it doesn't matter. But, you argued, and I would agree, it really does matter.
I think there's no question about it. I'll preface my House of Cards comments by saying that was also Netflix, interestingly enough.
Oh, that's right.
And when I dug into it, I found out that the producers had contracted one of the professional Washington lobbyists against these kinds of programs, one of the co-founders of the Third Way neoliberal democratic group. So, you know, I mean, I would say there's a pattern there, but perhaps not. But with House of Cards, what it was there was a protracted scene where Frank Underwood, the president, is, spoiler for anyone who hasn't seen the first is giving a talk and saying, well, you know, he's going to come up with a bold plan that only a ruthless, amoral leader like him could come up with. So he's going to take all the bloodsuckers out of Social Security, which is leeching the system dry, and he's going to slash it, and he's going to move the money over to young people and jobs and things that need to be done, which is a fundamental, first of all, misstatement of the facts. Retiree Social Security is one of the lowest programs of its kind, if not the lowest, in the developed world. Compared to other developed countries, we have a very weak, not overly generous system. So that the initial premise was flawed. Secondly, you know, it's money that people have paid into an insurance program, so you can't just take people's money that was paid for future benefits and build roads with it. That's what we have taxation and other sources of revenue for. So, and when I spoke up about it, you know, the reason why these things matter, whether it's the scene in Orange Is the New Black, whether it's the episode in House of Cards, is that pop culture forms the basis of our worldview for a lot of people. They don't know, they don't study these things, but you know, yeah, Frank Underwood, he's so crazy, he actually tells us the truth about Social Security. Or Orange Is the New Black, I saw how easy it is to rip off the system. Those kids getting disability payments are just being manipulated by their parents to game the system. That is exactly how people are softened up as you pointed out, for the policy changes that especially the Republicans are so eager to foist on us. So I think it's really, really important. And by the way, when I wrote the House of Cards piece, Neil Cavuto on Fox did a whole segment on how crazy I was, and he ended it by saying, oh, you know, it's only a TV show, Richard. My first name is Richard. It's only, and I've been on his show, actually. He's the only TV show, Richard. I don't know why you're getting so excited. And I wanted to say, yeah, because you guys at Fox never get excited about what the liberal media puts on a TV show. That never worries you guys or gets you worked up. So
I hope you put his comments on your resume.
Oh, well, along with Rush Limbaugh's attack on me, I've been... Yeah, a person is known by the enemies they make, right?
But to take your point right and to put a concrete example on it, before we wrap, Nick Kristof, who is a columnist for the New York Times, which is sometimes seen as certainly not seen as right wing media, but it is sometimes seen as more left of center. And Nick Kristof himself is sometimes seen of left of center. He wrote a column back in 2013, maybe 2012, 2013, and it was all about how he believed, based on some conversations he had had with people in Appalachia, that parents were actually intentionally keeping their children from learning how to read so that they could get them SSI children's benefits. He literally made that allegation, and it took hold in the public conscience, such that now we actually have legislation that's just been reintroduced in the House called the School Attendance Improves Lives Act. Of course, it sounds like apple pie and Mother's Day, right? But what that bill would do is to cut off SSI benefits to children with the most significant disabilities and the most severe illnesses if they miss any school. And the whole underlying premise of the bill, based on its sponsor's statements, is we need to make sure that kids are staying in school. And its entire foundation came from that lie that Nick Kristof perpetuated, if not started, in his column. So just an example of how these kinds of things really can take hold and become legislation by anecdote.
And there is no way that not knowing how to read qualifies a child for this type of benefit. So it is absolutely a folktale. I'm very disappointed. I mean, I don't always agree with Nick Kristof, but he seems like a bright guy, conscientious. I'm very disappointed whenever I see some. I mean, there are other columnists who I'm not disappointed because my expectations are pretty low. But, you know, it is disappointing with somebody like Nick Kristof. And that kind of legislation to me is the cruelest kind of a bullying, kind of blaming the victim. We're talking about severely, again, going back to the qualifications as defined by Social Security, we're talking about marked and severe medical conditions, severely limiting, resulting in severe inability to perform the activities of life and or imminent death. That's who we're talking about. Oh, but you got to be in school every morning. Well, those are the kids that, you know, there are good reasons why they might not be able to be in school every morning. So it's just the heartlessness is mind-boggling to me.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, just to put another number to how strict the SSI disability standards are, it's fewer than 1 in 4 kids with disabilities in the U.S. get benefits. So the program really is reserved for the kids with the most significant, the most severe disabilities and illnesses. My guest is R.J. Eskow, host of The Zero Hour on the WEACT radio network and also syndicated in various places across the U.S. R.J., thank you so much for being on with me for this lovely vent session. I feel much better after talking with you.
Yeah, I do too.
We'll have you back soon.
Rebecca. Always a pleasure.
Great, thanks. And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT radio network, or probably on iTunes, because really, who has radios anymore?
And continue the conversation with us on Twitter using the hashtag TalkPoverty and tweet directly at us with the handle @TalkPoverty.
Special thanks, as always, go out to our co-executive producers, Alyssa Peterson and Greg Kaufman, also the press team and the poverty team.
And as always, our friend, Chris Stiles Bacon.
Take it away, Chris Stiles.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handle. handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And it got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food and healthcare, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes. They got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom. Freedom. Sad, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking about?